I wonder if you've ever bought a good picture. Maybe it's after a tour of an art gallery and something struck you and you wanted to buy a print. Maybe it was a gift. But one thing you want when you've bought a good picture or taken a good photo is you want a nice frame to show it off. You want something to make it stand out, something that complements the composition of the picture. You occasionally hear stories about somebody finding an unframed masterpiece in their attic, covered in dust, maybe just a roll of canvas, and it's got the signature of some great artist on there. They didn't realize it was just a roll of canvas. How different it would appear when it's set in a beautiful frame and it's displayed on the wall. On a visit, I think, to Deerham Park, certainly it was some National Trust place, I saw two pictures on a wall. One of them is the genuine article. The other one is a fake, a copy of the other one. The way, apparently, you can tell the difference is in the frame. They have different frames. The one with the more ornate frame is actually the fake. They give it a more ornate frame to try and make it look more authentic. The difference is in the frames. Now, this Bible passage that we're looking at this evening, chapter 26 of Deuteronomy, is part of a frame, if you like. The other part of the frame is chapter 12 in Deuteronomy. What we have in this section are God's laws for how his people were to live in the land. And chapters 12 and 26 give us the frame that surround God's laws. It's the context in which God's people are to live out God's commands. It helps us to see where do we put these laws in our understanding. You see, understanding how God's laws fit into the whole of the life of God's people is essential for us to understand. It's essential for us sat here this evening because we are God's people. We have God's laws in front of us in our Bible. We need to understand the frame in which to set those laws. So these sections, chapter 26 and chapter 12, are like frames or section dividers in the book of Deuteronomy. Like an introduction in chapter 12, a conclusion in 26. And they cover similar themes of thankfulness and worship of God in the place that he chooses for his name. Look at verse 2 of chapter 26. Take some of the first fruits of all that the Lord your God is giving you and put them in a basket. Then go to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name. They were to take the produce of the land to the place where God chose. That was the place he did choose was Jerusalem. Just turn back with me to chapter 12. Chapter 12 of Deuteronomy. Chapter 12, and let's look at verse 5. But you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. That was Jerusalem. To that place you must go. There bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and special gifts, what you have vowed to give and your freewill offerings and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. This was about the sacrifices that God's people were to bring, the way they were to worship him and to give thanks to him. So these two chapters act as bookends around everything that's in between. They give us the context, the framework, or the lens through which we are meant to understand everything in between. So there are two things I want us to think about tonight. Firstly, I want to say, frame your life with thankfulness. Frame your life with thankfulness. If regularly giving thanks to God is an everyday part of your life, then you will inevitably set your obedience to God's laws in the right context. Now, that's a statement that needs some unpacking. Basically, what I'm saying is this. Giving thanks protects us from two errors. It protects us not just to, but these are the two we're going to think about tonight. And the first is this. The first error is thinking that we are on God's side because of our obedience. Thinking that we are on God's side because of our obedience. I want to coin a phrase. You may have heard this already. A checklist mentality. A checklist mentality. I don't know if you keep a to-do list. You can get an app for your phone. You can get many apps for your phone that are to-do list managers. You can categorize all the things you have to do. You can prioritize all the things you have to do. You can put due dates against all the things you have to do. But the most satisfying part of these apps is being able to tick the box. You get a nice green tick in the box that says, yes, I've done that. Very satisfying. What I want to say is that a checklist mentality to God's laws is to put them in a long list. Maybe add some extras that you think are missing. Because we learned, didn't we, last week, that actually these laws are not exhaustive. What Tom was saying last week, he was reminding us that we're to paint God's laws into every corner of our lives. We're not just to be just. We're to actually have generous justice that goes beyond, that always thinks, what more can I do to serve somebody? You see, the problem with a checklist mentality is that as soon as you limit obedience to a finite list that has a start and an end, you've reduced the standard of righteousness below what the law requires. You're saying this is righteousness and no more. The error is thinking that you can become acceptable to God through obedience to that list alone. It's lowering the pass mark so that we get through the entrance exam. God's standard of righteousness far exceeds our own. Remember the Pharisees, whom Jesus frequently encountered in the Gospels. They were experts in the law. They could tell you in an instant whether something somebody was doing was on the right side of the law or not. And they did. And in fact, they enjoyed telling people that. They were so into the details of the law that they even tithed their herbs and spices. Imagine that basil plant on your windowsill counting out a tenth of those leaves to give as a tithe. But this is what Jesus says about the Pharisees. Matthew chapter 5, verse 20. Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. By thinking that they had all God's law tied up and neatly defined, they'd actually reduced it to the level of human righteousness. But God's standard, says Jesus, is far higher. We need to realize, don't we, that we fall dramatically short of God's standards. We can't meet God's standards to become part of his people. Maybe people you talk to think that they're actually quite righteous. They give to charity. Maybe they even volunteer for a charity. They chat to their lonely neighbors, do some shopping for them. But they still fall short of God's standards of righteousness. God's people are not those who are holy enough for God. God's people are those who give thanks that God has made them his people, despite their not meeting his standard in themselves. So, if you give thanks to God, this error is minimized. Look at verses 1 to 11. Verses 1 to 11. When you have entered the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance and have taken possession of it and settled in it, take some of the first fruits of all that you produce from the soil of the land the Lord your God is giving you and put them in a basket. Notice all the things that God has done as we read through these verses. Go to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling place for his name. And say to the priests in office at the time, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come to the land the Lord swore to our forefathers to give us. The priest shall take the basket from your hands and set it down in front of the altar of the Lord your God. Then you shall declare before the Lord your God, My father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down into Egypt with a few people and lived there and became a great nation, powerful and numerous. But the Egyptians mistreated us and made us suffer, putting us to hard labor. Then we cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our misery, toil, and oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. With great terror and with miraculous signs and wonders, he brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now I bring the first fruits of the soil that you, O Lord, have given me. Place the basket before the Lord your God and bow down before him. And you and the Levites and the aliens among you shall rejoice in all the good things the Lord your God has given to you and your household. Giving thanks is all about what God has already done. God's people were in a situation in which they were helpless, slaves in Egypt, unattractive and unpromising as a nation. To give thanks to God for his rescue and gift of the land would serve as a reminder that they didn't achieve this by their own merit. Jesus talks about this similar distinction in Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. This is the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, and adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. You see, the Pharisee in that parable there thinks that he's got it all tied up. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector knows he hasn't. He knows he falls short. He's a sinner. And his only plea is for God to do something for him. God, have mercy on me. And the one who went home on the right side of the law was the tax collector. He goes home justified before God because he realizes he needs God's mercy. So that's the first error that giving thanks to God protects us from. The second error that giving thanks to God protects us from is thinking that God's laws don't matter because we're already his people. Let's look at verses 16 to 19 of chapter 26 of Deuteronomy. These verses explain the need for God's people to follow God's commands. The Lord your God commands you this day to follow these decrees and laws. Carefully observe them with all your heart and with all your soul. You have declared this day that the Lord is your God and that you will walk in his ways, that you will keep his decrees, commands, and laws, and that you will obey him. And the Lord has declared this day that you are his people, his treasured possession, as he promised, and that you are to keep all his commands. He has declared that he will set you in praise, fame, and honor high above all the nations he has made, and that you will be a people holy to the Lord your God, as he promised. I don't know if you thought, as I thought, when I first read through this, that it sounds a little bit like a marriage ceremony. There's a repetition of the things that the two parties have promised to one another. A reminder, this tying up of the covenant. This is what the groom has promised, this is what the bride has promised. This is what will put the frame in the relationship between these people. So here, God calls on his people to obey all the laws, and the people agree to this. You see, that God has saved his people through no merit of their own does not mean that he doesn't care how they behave. You see, a married couple doesn't conclude that as soon as the marriage ceremony is over, that now they have that fixed bond, that now they're free to go and date whoever they like, because their marriage bond is secure. That's ludicrous, isn't it? You see, giving thanks to God for his salvation ensures that his people live their obedience to the max. Obedience to the max. If Israel ever stopped giving thanks to God, their obedience would stop short of all that it was meant to be. They'd be thinking this, what's the minimum I have to do in order to comply? You see, they wouldn't be concerned about painting into all the corners, but checking off the list. I don't know what you're like when you paint, whether you're somebody who likes to use a roller and just do all the, you know, the big areas quickly, or whether you're somebody who likes to get the small paintbrush and tuck it into the corners. God's people with God's laws are those who want to do everything, paint the big areas and tuck the paintbrush right into the corners, just like Tom was saying. Obedience to the max. Two attitudes, minimum versus maximum. There's an example of this in the New Testament when Peter questioned Jesus at Matthew chapter 18. I'll read this out for us. Matthew 18. Peter asks, how many times shall I forgive someone? How many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Seven times? He thought he was being quite generous with seven times. Is that the limit? Seven times? Jesus answers, no, 77 times. 77 times. He's saying there's no limit. There's no limit to the times you should forgive someone. And then to illustrate his point, Jesus goes on to tell the parable of the unmerciful servant. This is where there's the servant who owes a debt to his master. And he says, I can't pay. I can't pay. Please release me from my debt. So the master releases him from the debt. That servant then goes to someone who owes him a tiny amount of money. And he says, you must pay me my money. I'll get you thrown in prison if you don't pay me your money. You see, that unmerciful servant didn't realize the enormity of the debt that he'd been forgiven. There was no thankfulness in his heart. There was no attitude of obedience to the max. What more can I do? So he was not grateful and not merciful. Jesus also says in another place that those who have been forgiven little love little. Don't forget how much you have been forgiven by continually giving thanks. How do we do this? How should we go about doing this? Here's one example. At the end of the day, if you reflect on how it has gone, this is to yourself in your own head, maybe as you pray before you go to sleep, I wonder, do you list off in your head all the commands that you've broken? Maybe you say this, I've fallen short in X, Y, and Z. Better try harder tomorrow. That is still self-righteousness. You see, whether you've put a green tick in the box or a red cross in the box, you've still reduced obedience to a checklist. Rather, we should say something like this, Lord, I know I've failed you in many ways today. Some I've seen and know. Others I am ignorant of. I know that the blood of Jesus covers all my sins. Please can I know and feel your forgiveness for my sinful choices today. I repent of my bad choices today. Help me to step out into tomorrow, knowing that my great debt of sin is covered. May I know I am forgiven much, so that I would love much. And praying like that will help us to live obedience to the max, painting God's laws into every corner, nook, and cranny of our lives. So those are two errors that we're protected from by a life framed with thankfulness, thinking that we're on God's side because of obedience, and thinking that God's laws don't matter because we're already his people. So that's two reasons to give thanks. Now we'll look at two things that God's people are to give thanks for. So give thanks because. Give thanks because God has caught you up in his story. This is what I'm saying. God's redemption story is our redemption story. Just look at what the worshipper at the beginning of the chapter, chapter 26, is meant to do. They come with a basket of food that they've grown, the first fruits of their crops. They come to the priest in Jerusalem, and they say this, "I declare today to the Lord your God that I've come to the land the Lord swore to our forefathers to give us." And then they recite something. Partway through verse 5, this is what they are to say. This is a story, if you like, a narrative. "My father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down into Egypt with a few people, lived there and became a great nation, powerful and numerous. But the Egyptians mistreated us and made us suffer, putting us to hard labor. Then we cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our misery, toil, and oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror and with miraculous signs and wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey." That's the history part. That's what God did. And then, it's not just something remote in history. It's something that this worshipper, it's actually his story. "And now I bring the first fruits of the soil that you, O Lord, have given me." God's story is our story. Whenever any Israelite brought his tithe offering to the temple, they would say this, it was probably something like a creed that they would recite, narrating why it is they can come to the temple with a basket full of crops in their hands. They're carrying the evidence in their hands that they themselves have been caught up in God's plan of redemption. And on their lips, they're reciting that story of how God chose Israel and rescued them, and how he gave them the land he promised. So not just a story about what God had done in history, but a story about what God had done for them. Now, every day we talk about our lives with people, people at work, friends, family members. And sometimes we actually find ourselves declaring or living by different stories. We reflect in our lives with the way we speak about our circumstances to our colleagues or in front of our children. We might find ourselves narrating a different story. I'll give you a few examples. "I'm a failure. I'm just an expert at mucking things up. I only got this job because there was no one better. I wasn't the first choice. I was just the only one who applied. And when they see my work, they'll soon regret that decision. People don't really care about me. They just tolerate me. If they really understood me, they'd rather have other friends. I'm a hard worker who just deserves some peace and quiet. I deserve a good night's sleep. The kids shouldn't be waking up. I want to feel special. People should notice how hard I'm working at serving them. Maybe if I did more or did it better, then they'd notice." Now, we may or may not phrase them like this, but these storylines begin to emerge when we dig deeper at our angry outbursts, maybe our deepest fears or our strongest desires. But God's people know the real story to live by. It's God's story, and it's our story. It's a story of God choosing a people for himself. "Then you shall declare before the Lord your God, my father was a wandering Aramean. He went down into Egypt with a few people, lived there, became a great nation, powerful and numerous. This is all that God did for his people. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And now I bring the first fruits of the soil that you, O Lord, have given me. We can say for ourselves, I was made for God's glory, yet chose to live a life that seeks glory for myself. I worked hard to find pleasure in this life. I sinned and dishonored the God who made me. I followed my own ways and listened to my own counsel. But God rescued me from that slavery to sin and made me his child. He gave me his spirit. He forgave my sins and has promised me an eternal home of joy and pleasure in knowing him. Each day he brings me new opportunities to serve him and know him better and become more like Jesus. And then we can continue the story in various ways, in each of our own different circumstances. Maybe like this. So I know that the challenging relationship at work is a means for God to humble me and make me more like Christ. Or we continue. So this means that though I do sometimes fail, my identity is not that of a failure, but of a precious child of God. Or maybe this. This means my service is seen by God, and I know he is the only witness which matters. Whether people appreciate me or ignore me, I know that God has called me his own. Now, which version of the story do you prefer? You're probably familiar with children choosing the stories they'd like read to them. They have their favorites. Everyone likes a good story. A favorite in our house at the moment is The First Hippo on the Moon. It's a great story about an underdog hippo who wants to be the first hippo on the moon. They always go for the ones that have a great ending. There's not many stories, children's stories actually, that have a sad ending. Nobody likes a sad ending to a story. Maybe you've heard people say about stories, well, the best ones aren't true. Well, this is the best story, and it's true. And it's the one that God's people can live by. But notice this, the story is not yet finished. The story is not yet finished. Look at verses 18 and 19. This is what God is saying to his people before they go into the land. And the story for them was not yet finished. Verse 18. And the Lord has declared this day that you are his people, his treasured possession, as he promised, and that you are to keep all his commands. He has declared that he will set you in praise, fame, and honor, high above all the nations he has made, and that you will be a people holy to the Lord your God, as he promised. God's redemptive story is not just a story about the past, what God has done, what God has done for Israel. It's a story about what he will do for Israel. Israel was set apart to be a nation that revealed God to the world. And sadly, we learn through the rest of the Old Testament that Israel failed in that way. But the story didn't end there. God sent his son, Jesus, who lived as the true Israelite. Jesus was the one who revealed and continues to reveal the Father to this world. Just as Adi was reminding us this morning, Jesus is the one who reveals the Father to us. But even that isn't where the story ends. The story, for us, doesn't end there. We've been caught up in God's story of redemption. We're going to turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter 2, and verse 9, This is a letter that Peter, who was an apostle of Jesus, he wrote to encourage God's people to continue living in this world for God as they awaited what was to come, their inheritance, their final salvation, where they were to be taken home to live with God forever. And this is what Peter reminds them of. Chapter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. This is the story that we are part of. And I think we should take every opportunity we can to declare God's story as our own. We can do this in many ways. We do this in many ways. We do it in song. A little bit later, I think we're going to be doing it with some words. Words not sung. Declaring truths about God and how we have been caught up in God's story. We sing songs like this. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. Or, I was blinded by my sin. Had no ears to hear your voice. Did not know your love within. Had no taste for heaven's joys. Then your spirit gave me life. Opened up your word to me. Through the gospel of your son, gave me endless hope and peace. This is our story, and we can declare it in our conversations with one another. When we're reflecting on our lives, about the circumstances of our lives, we can help one another to interpret these and see these through the lens of God's redemptive narrative. And then we can give thanks together that God has caught us up in his story. God has caught us up in his story. The second thing we can give thanks for, more briefly, is that God has given generously to you. God has given generously to you. Israel were also to give thanks because, quite simply, God had been enormously generous to them. This creed that they were to recite as they worshipped is just a declaration of so many things that God had done for them. About rescue from Egypt. About bringing them into a wonderful land. About how he supplied them with the food they needed, not just for them, but so they could give to others. So that not only they were satisfied, but so that the widow could be satisfied, the fatherless could be satisfied. Not just survival, but they were promised luxury, a land flowing with milk and honey. And as we thought with the children, verse 12, enough to be filled, to be satisfied. This was going to be a welfare state run with a budget surplus and no complaints from the Office for Budget Responsibility. You see, if someone is given generously to you, it means there's plenty to spare. And it's expected that in Israel, God will so bless them that not only those who farm the land will have food, but that there will be enough for those without farms. And this giving of the tithe, tithe just simply means a tenth. That was simply a reflection of who this produce primarily belonged to. You see, it wasn't the farmer who so skillfully made it grow. It was God. God had given them the land in which they planted the seed. God had brought the rain to water the plants. God had brought the sunshine to make them grow. He had made the ground produce fruit. The Israelites were not the owners by right, but the owners by gift. And this is why they brought the first fruits, because it was first and foremost God's. They were acting as stewards. And this giving thanks for daily supplies of food was not just for those under this covenant. Even before this, people recognized that God was the giver of daily bread. Right back in Genesis chapter 4, we find people giving thanks to God for what he has given them. So Genesis 4, verse 2. Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. These were the two sons of Adam and Eve. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. You see, we have there Abel giving thanks to God with the firstborn of his flock. Even before any covenant, even before any land has been given, before any people have been chosen. Daily bread is something that we should thank God for today. Saying a prayer of thanks before we eat is part of that. I once saw my church back home had lots of international visitors. There was an English language school nearby, and missionaries would come to train. And there was a man from Korea who came to learn English. And after a service, I saw him with a cup of tea and a biscuit, giving thanks to God. He closed his eyes and he gave thanks to God for the cup of tea in his hand. I'm not saying necessarily that's something that we need to be doing, but we do need to have that continual attitude of thankfulness to God for all that we have been given. That's why, as part of our worship of God, we give a proportion of our income for the work of the church as a way to give thanks. We're recognizing that what we have is not our own. We're saying that we only have money in our bank accounts because of God's provision. He gives us skills and abilities and employment to use them. We, like Israel, have so much to be thankful for, not just our daily bread, but just as Israel gave thanks for their rescue, for their redemption, for the promise of a wonderful land, so we should give thanks for the whole redemption that God has worked for us in the past and promised us in the future, just as we were thinking earlier. Just look at what you can give thanks for. I quoted this with the children, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. I mean, that's satisfaction, isn't it? That's what being filled is all about. The pouring out of the life of the Lord Jesus. He emptied himself of life so that we could be filled with life to the full, life to the max, as we've been learning about in John. That is fullness, fullness of life, satisfied. And Paul wrote this because he wanted to encourage the church in Corinth to get their wallets out. Not just for their money, but for them to have a whole life of thankfulness. But he was saying it does include that. Being thankful means getting your wallets out. You see, that's what you do when you understand how generously God has given to you. And later on he says, thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. Indescribable gift. God has given generously to you. So my aim tonight has been to help you to see how we only place obedience to God's laws in the right place when we frame them with a life of thankfulness. And when we do that, we remember that obedience to God's law is not the entry ticket to his kingdom. and that obedience to the max is the desire of God's people. And I've also wanted to show you two big reasons we have to be thankful, that we've been caught up in God's story, and that God has been so generous to us. I hope, like me, you desire for this to be a marker of our church community. And what we're going to do right now is we're going to declare in song God's redemption story. Not just that God has done this, but God has done this for us. We're going to sing, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see." Let's stand and give thanks to God.